Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret today. And coming up, a year in the life of a teacher. We'll meet the journalist who followed the struggles and successes of educators in the classroom and in their personal lives. Now, making delicious and healthy meals in the kitchen doesn't have to be expensive or take hours to prepare. Some of us can't afford the fancy fare, the rare ingredients, but we still need to find ways to feed our families. Fortunately, low budget doesn't have to mean low flavor. It's Food Friday, and today we're talking all about saving money in the kitchen and the grocery store with the help of someone who's mastered it in her own life for her own family. Join us, 1-800-642-1234. How do you make your money stretch further in the kitchen? What's your favorite cheap and easy meal, go-to meal? And what questions do you have about keeping costs for cooking down? 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lexi Rogers is a chef and mother of four who competed on season 11 of the reality cooking show Master Chef. Her new cookbook is called Break Bread on a Budget. Ordinary ingredients, extraordinary meals. Lexi, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Great. I think we're on the same page here when it comes to breaking bread on a budget. So I'm very interested in talking to you because when I got your book, I'm like, all right, this is going to be about dried beans, right? Dried beans. We're just going to talk about dried beans here. And that was far from the case. You run the gamut in your cookbook and you do it on a budget. And I'm just fascinated with it. Let's start, though, with your experience on MasterChef. The judges were amazed when you said you could feed your family on $40 a week. It was just you and your husband back then, and you've added a few more mouths since then. But how did you do it? What was your secret?
So we just took really simple items and tried to make them as flavorful as possible, knowing what kind of, you know, ingredients pair well together really helped. We ate a lot of rice. We still eat a lot of rice, a lot of potatoes, pasta, things like that are cheap and can take up a lot of the bulk of your meal and fill you up. And then you can swap them out and make them delicious by the things that you add to that. And those ingredients don't have to cost very much either.
Yeah. What was your experience like on MasterChef? How was that for you?
It was a little bit stressful. It was a lot of bit stressful. Gordon is, you know, he can be very intimidating. I had no culinary background going onto the show, and I later found out that a decent amount of my fellow contestants had a lot more experience, whether they've traveled the world and tasted different types of cuisines or actually like went to school or grew up in restaurants themselves. So I felt a lot of pressure. I felt really out of place. I also was pregnant and didn't realize it until like the day after I got there. Oh. So that was a challenge in itself. But I had a lot of fun. I made a lot of great friends. I learned a lot about, you know, flavor and what things can pair well together. And I took that and I still apply that today in the kitchen.
You wrote in your book that you initially felt ashamed of being labeled as the poor black girl, but you've grown instead to be proud of the ingenuity you have in the kitchen. And can you take us through some of what it was like for you and your feelings around identity and cooking?
Yeah. So when you get there, you know, MasterChef is supposed to be exquisite. It's the top of the top. You're supposed to be plating really beautifully. You're supposed to be taking ingredients and elevating them. And while that is something that I tried to do minimalistically, it wasn't something that I had a ton of experience with. And I was just, you know, notice that a lot of times they'll take, you know, like black single mothers, which I'm married to, you know, my husband, Lewis, but black single mothers and people who just don't have a lot of resources, and then just kind of like make that their, you know, their title and say, okay, well, this is what we expect from you. And I wanted to be so much more than that. I wanted to show that, you know, my race didn't matter, how little or how much I had to cook with didn't matter. And that there's other people, a whole community of people who are just like me, who are able to do these same things and kind of be an inspiration to those people as well. And so I took it very seriously. I knew that this was something that they were, kind of trying to, you know, force on me and label me as. And, while I didn't appreciate that during the show, I realized afterwards I can use that same thing and really try to impact, you know, my community.
Chef Lexi Rogers, our guest. Her new cookbook is Break Bread on a Budget, Ordinary Ingredients and Extraordinary Meals. And while you talk about being an inspiration for others, your book also talks about your inspiration, Lexi, your auntie and your grandma. Tell us about them.
Yes. So my grandma and my aunt both live in inner city Chicago. It's where my father grew up, and I would visit them and sometimes stay with them for extended periods during the summer. And the thing that I loved the most about my grandmother was that she would cook. And before we would come over, she would ask, like, is there anything that you want to eat? And is there anything that I can get you? Random people stopped by and knew that she was making dinner and just took a plate, said hi, took a plate and went about their way. And I just thought that was so beautiful. It wasn't something that I saw a lot until I started really spending time over there. And it really inspired me, the way that she was able to take food and really simple ingredients and make something that tasted delicious, but also really brought people together. And it was really something that, you know, touched me, something that I wanted to also be able to share with other people.
Yeah, feeding as feeding others as love of others. And I think that's something my grandmother imparted to me. So, Lexi, let's get down to it then. Let's talk about how you can build a meal for a whole family on a real tight budget. And a few rules that stuck out to me. Number one, don't shop hungry. That's a bad idea. The second one, though, I think is kind of tough for me. Don't cook tired. That's not a good idea. But sometimes that can be tough. What are some of the rules of the road that you abide by?
Yes. So when I talk about not cooking tired, one of the biggest things is not just physical tired, but it's mental exhaustion. And a lot of times you take the idea of, okay, what am I going to cook today? And what am I going to eat for lunch? And then what am I going to make for my kids for tomorrow? And what are we going to pack for them? And all these things, there's so many decisions to make, so many choices. And so I like to, before the week even begins, say, okay, this is what we're going to do. These are the meals we're going to have on Monday, all the things we're going to have on Tuesday. Wednesday is going to be a leftover day. And so it just kind of takes some of that tiredness out before my week even begins. I know what that week is going to look like. My family knows what it's going to look like, and just kind of gives us a little bit more peace. And so you have a little bit more energy throughout your week.
And then, Lexi, you take that menu and you turn it into a grocery list that becomes kind of like what you're going to stick to once you get there.
Correct. Exactly. Which, again, helps save money. You get to the store and you're like, oh, I don't really know what I'm going to make for this week. You just kind of end up grabbing random items, and then you have to figure out what to turn them into. Maybe you don't have a certain ingredient, and you run back to the store to get something to make that into a meal. And you keep doing that throughout the week. And before you know it, you've spent way more than you would like to. You've traveled to the grocery store a lot more than you'd like to, which cuts into, you know, your gas budget or whatever. And you're also a lot more tired. I personally do not like to cook after I grocery shop. So whatever day is my grocery shop day, that day we're either having frozen pizza or we're having leftovers or something really simple. I don't want to touch food after that. I'll get in the kitchen the next day. But if you're running to the store all the time, it becomes difficult to do that. And so I think it's really important to have a weekly menu. I think anything longer than a week, you start to get a little bit overwhelmed, or things start to, you know, go bad in your fridge and you forget them or whatever. But, you know, a week seems to be a good amount of time for me and my family to focus on and just kind of work with that.
Lexi Rogers, our guest. She is the author of the new cookbook, Break Bread on a Budget, Ordinary Ingredients, Extraordinary Meals. And you can join us with your suggestions and how you make the dollar go further in your grocery store or once you get to the kitchen, 1-800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. What are some of the staples that you have on hand in the Rogers household, Lexi?
So we always have frozen veggies, you know, frozen broccoli, frozen peas. Sometimes if I'm really lazy, like a frozen medley is in there. We always have rice. I buy extremely large bags of rice, 10-pound bags of rice. They don't go bad. And you can put them in a lot of different things. Another staple is chicken. It's easy to freeze, easy to thaw out. It'll stay good in your freezer for about a year, almost a year. And so if you have that on hand, then you always have either a protein or a starch. Same thing with potatoes. I like to keep a lot of potatoes around. and butter. Always keep butter. I say butter is flavor, and we like to have lots of that. So I can freeze my butter as well. And when I have a little bit more, then I'll you know, put some of it towards grabbing an extra thing of butter, because it can be expensive if you're, you know, if you don't actually have that built into your budget. So I try to keep that on hand as well. And then my favorite seasoning, I'm not sponsored by these people at all, but Tony's Cajun seasoning is my favorite. I write about it in my book.
Yes, you do.
I use it in a lot of my recipes. I'm telling you, I will put that on anything, and it makes it taste amazing. So
I put it
definitely
on my grocery list.
You guys
list.
To invest yeah. in that.
I caught that in your book, and I appreciate that. There's another staple that you write in your book that surprised me, because it took me back to college, and I think I had so much of it in college, I haven't even thought of it as an adult. Ramen noodles.
Ramen.
Actually. Yeah.
Yes. We love ramen.
How do you use it?
I use it, you know, pretty much how they tell you to cook it. I sometimes we don't actually make it with like in a soup. Sometimes we'll toss it in like soy sauce or some other kind of sauce and make it more of like a pasta kind of thing. You can add a bunch of different stuff to it, chicken, shrimp, salmon, sometimes crispy fried onions or soft boiled eggs, hard boiled eggs. I mean, so many different choices that you can add to that and just make it like a nice filling dish. And the actual packets itself are extremely cheap. The seasoning that comes with it doesn't taste bad as either. If you want to be a little more healthy, because I know there's a lot of MSG in there, you can make your own seasoning. We use chicken bouillon cubes instead of chicken broth. And so those things, I think a jar of it is like $2 in some sense, and you get like 20 plus different bouillon cubes in there, and you can grind them up however you please, chop it up with the fork. I have a mortar and pestle that I like to grind it up with, mix it with some water and some other different seasonings, and then add that to my noodles as well if I want to be a little bit healthier. But yeah, no, there's so many different choices, and we love to cook with ramen.
Yeah, it's so cheap. Break bread on a budget, ordinary ingredients, extraordinary meals, a new cookbook from our guest, Lexi Rogers. And you can join our conversation with how you make the dollar go further when you cook your meals for your family, your tips, and what's been passed down from generation to generation to you at 1-800-642-1234. Go ahead and post on our Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue our conversation and hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with Chef Lexi Rogers. She competed in the reality cooking show Master Chef, and she's with us today to talk about her low-cost cooking and her new cookbook, Break Bread on a Budget, Ordinary Ingredients, Extraordinary Meals. And we invite you to join our conversation at 1-800-642-1234, where Peggy in Cumberland standing by. Peggy, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Great, thanks. What do you have for us today?
Oh, well, I was going to tell you about my mom's pour soup.
Oh.
She got the recipe from my dad's mother, who raised kids in the Depression.
Yep.
And it's really basic, and it's pretty yummy, actually. You take half a pot of water, bring it up to a good boil, and drop little bits of hamburger in it. We usually use like a pound of hamburger. Let it boil for a while till the hamburger's all cooked out, and then I always stick it in the fridge overnight so I can skim the fat off and let the flavor set in a little. And then the next day, bring it up to boiling again, add an onion, a chopped onion, and a bunch of potatoes cut into pieces, and it's so good.
And so affordable.
You gotta serve it with some homemade bread, though.
You
gotta dunk it.
Oh, nice.
Lexi, what's your thought on Ma's pour soup here?
Sounds so interesting. I've never tried that or heard of that before, but it's giving me some ideas of things that I could maybe use in my kitchen too.
My idea for you.
So thank you.
Yeah, I was thinking that Tony's Cajun seasoning would go great in that.
Right?
Exactly. And you've got a chapter in your book about soups and how to make those stretch, and the bouillon makes sense to me. What are some other tips you have for making soups stretch for the whole family?
Well, you mentioned it earlier, and I'm going to say beans.
Yeah. Thank you.
We like to use beans, and even if you don't want like the actual bean in there, you can blend it up and add it to your soup as a thickening agent, and then It gives it a little bit, you know, makes it a little heartier and makes it feel like the soup is stretching further.
Yeah, when I was on a tight budget, it was bean soup, it was bean salad. You could take vinegar and oil and take a bag of beans, soak them up, get them nice and soft, and then they could become just about anything. But they're always, for me, a really cheap protein. But, mm-hmm. I mean, that was such a small part of your book, Lexi, that I was amazed. Another part of your book is the way you use, and I mentioned vinegar before, pickling to preserve. And you've got a little bit of that in there. Tell us about how we can use pickling to save things, make them stretch, and keep them for as long as we need them.
Yeah, I mean, you can pickle almost any vegetable that you have in your fridge that's potentially going bad. It's super easy to do. I think you take one part of water, one part of vinegar, boil it together, add your veggies, and then I like to put a little bit of sugar in there as well just because the vinegar taste could be kind of strong. Seal it up in a jar, let it sit in your fridge overnight, and you've got a snack that you can use that could have potentially been thrown away.
Lexi, you talk a lot about eggs for breakfast in your book, The Incredible Edible Egg. But most recently, I've seen The Incredibly Expensive Egg. And I was
correct,
wondering how
yeah.
you and your family's budget dealt with the recent high cost of eggs.
Yes, eggs have become a lot more expensive than they were when I was first writing this book. We have been using a lot of oatmeal for breakfast. We use a lot of homemade pancakes, which are super easy and cheap. Flour is not that expensive. Mm-hmm. And if I do use eggs, I would like to reference the mini frittata recipe that's in the book. And I like that one because you can use the recipe exactly how I've listed it, or you can add in whatever kind of like leftovers you have from your week in there as well. So you take scrambled egg. Sometimes like we'll have leftover turkey sausage, or if you want to put little pieces of cooked bacon in there, some leftover veggies that are going to go bad instead of pickling them, mm-hmm. you can add them to an egg batter, put it in the oven, and then you can snack on them throughout the week.
How about picky eaters? You've got three kids who are eating at home, four now, and picky eating can be difficult, but picky eating on a budget may seem downright impossible. How do you overcome those not necessarily distinguished palates, but picky ones?
Yeah. So we do eat a lot of chicken because my son and salmon. My son, those are his two favorite proteins, and he is my pickiest eater. But I found that the thing that really helps us the most is having him in the kitchen with me and cooking with me, because then he feels like it's something that he made as opposed to looking at and saying, oh, I don't know what this is. This looks gross or it smells weird. You know, if he's a part of the process and he's in there with me and not really like cutting things, but, you know, like sauteing things, flipping things around, just knows what's going on, then he seems to be a lot more inclined to eat it afterwards.
You also talk about putting a thing of pizza dough down, a little pizza sauce and some cheese, and having the kids make their own pizzas real quick.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That is another really great, cheap meal to make. You can make your own pizza dough with yeast packets, which are incredibly cheap, and some flour that we probably all have on hand. Or what I've been doing lately, since I'm a little bit lazy, we talked about that mental exhaustion, don't want to tie yourselves out in the kitchen. If you go to Walmart, you can find a little thing called Pizza Buddy, and it's going to be with the Walmart brand freezer pizzas. And we take it, you thaw it out, you can roll it out, and it's just a pizza dough that's ready to go. It tastes much better, and it's much cheaper than buying, you know, the ones that come in a can and already rolled up, or the ones that are dried out and in the actual, like, pizza sauce section. So we've been doing that a decent amount, too, and adding, you know, just some, you can get regular tomato sauce that's not necessarily pizza sauce. Walmart sells them for like 80 cents.
Yep.
And season it. I'm going to add Tony's in there again. Season it and, you know, make it taste your own and use that instead of actually buying jars of pizza sauce, which can be a little bit more expensive. Yep. And then top it with some cheese and you've got a really nice dinner that everybody in the family can make and super easy to enjoy and eat.
Lexi Rogers, our guest for Food Friday today, her new cookbook, Break Bread on a Budget, Ordinary Ingredients, Extraordinary Meals. And here's where you got me, was with the can of biscuits and the everything you can do with a can of biscuits, from donuts to monkey bread to mozzarella monkey bread. Is there anything a can of biscuits can't do, Lexi?
No, not that I've seen.
So take us through how you would take a can of biscuits and turn it into some mozzarella monkey bread.
Yeah. So it's really easy to do. You can, you know, you pop the biscuits open. I like to cut each biscuit piece. You know, they're pre-separated. Cut each piece into four, flatten it out a little bit, cut a piece of mozzarella stick off, put it inside of the biscuit, seal it tight. And then I put it in a bun dish and layer them in there, add a little bit of melted butter, as well as some Italian seasoning. Put in the oven, take it out, and then you've got pull apart mozzarella monkey bread. It's delicious.
I'm looking forward to trying that because I've done the donuts and I've done the sweet monkey bread, but the mozzarella monkey bread is now on my list, on my grocery list, on my menu. What's on the Rogers family menu for this weekend, Lexi?
Yeah, so today we are going to have some chicken Indian curry. I have some red curry paste that's in the fridge. We, you know, it's really easy to make. Just grind up some. We like to grind up some ginger as well as a little bit of a splash of lime. There's some red peppers, roasted peppers in there, and some other Indian spices. And I add that to a little bit of coconut milk and cook my chicken in there. And then we serve it with rice on the side. And it's really delicious. My kids love it. I love it. And the leftovers taste even better the next day.
Lexi, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me. It was a joy.
Lexi Rogers is a chef and mother of four who competed on season 11 of the reality cooking show Master Chef. With us today to share her new cookbook, Break Bread on a Budget, Ordinary Ingredients, Extraordinary Meals. And we encourage you and invite you to see our full slate of Food Friday guests online anytime at your leisure, along with all the recipes to boot at WPR.org/Food Friday. Now, coming up Monday on the morning show, it's your state capitol report every Monday on the morning show. And Wisconsin Superintendent of Public Instruction joins Kate Archer Kent to talk about the education spending that's been cut from the governor's proposed state budget. Kate will also be talking with the head of the Department of Children and Families about the child care crisis in Wisconsin. Plus, don't miss the founder of the Wisconsin Cryptids, Anomalies, and Paranormal Society as they share all that's unexplained across our state. That's Monday morning on the morning show. This is Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Rob Ferret, and you're with us here on the Ideas Network. A 2022 survey from the National Education Association found that 55% of educators said they were considering leaving the profession. More than half. Why? Is it the pandemic? Is it the politics? The parents? The pay? And what do teachers have to say about it all? We're listening back now to a conversation, and you can tell us what you think at any time by emailing us ideas@WPR.org. Are you a teacher, and what's it like in your classroom today? How does the classroom affect your life outside the classroom? Have you considered leaving the profession? Or if you've already left, have you considered getting back in, unretiring? Join us with an email at any time, ideas@WPR.org. Alexandra Robbins is an author of 5 New York Times best-selling books and a Goodreads nonfiction book of the year. Her books include The Overachievers, The Secret Lives of Driven Kids. Her latest is called The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. I talked with her about it earlier this year. Here's a listen. So let's start with that National Education Association survey from last year. It found that 55% of educators were considering leaving their profession. What's your reaction to that?
That number might actually be low. The morale among teachers is extremely low right now. And it's not just because of the pandemic. The issues in the education system started before the pandemic. It's just the pandemic exacerbated them, and the treatment of teachers has gotten worse.
So it's not just the pandemic then. So what were these issues before the pandemic that teachers were seeing that were driving them to consider leaving the job?
Sure. Well, teachers are incredibly hardworking professionals who work an alarming number of hours unpaid. But instead of our gratitude and a proper salary, they're getting disparaged and demoralized. Right now, the teacher pay gap has hit a record high. U.S. teachers earn 24% less than professionals with similar education and experience. That's demoralizing. Then you have a job where district officials and sometimes principals pile on extra responsibilities onto teachers without giving them the resources, support staff, or planning time to do that within their paid contractual hours. So teachers are working late into the night, almost every night, trying to get their job done.
And yet at the same time, as you write in your new book, the teachers, they often have to take on secondary jobs just to pay the bills.
That's right. So I followed three teachers for a year to make it sort of an interesting behind the scenes story with characters who whom readers would work for. One of those teachers, Penny, she was an 18-year teaching veteran, an award-winning teacher, and she was making $47,000 a year. And she couldn't live on that. She had two extra jobs.
And there are two others that we'll get to, but we should also mention, Alexandra, that you were a substitute teacher as well. How did that experience suit you?
So it's interesting. I see what teachers mean by they love teaching, but they do not love being a teacher. The act of teaching is beautiful, just connecting with students and colleagues and having this mutual learning and growing experience and impacting their lives and seeing them make connections. There's just joy and exhilaration in that. You know, I grew up playing sports and I've experienced runner's high during sports, but teacher's high is way better. However, I subbed almost the whole year. I subbed more than 150 days out of 180. And for the whole year, including almost a semester spent as a full-time third grade teacher, I made $17,000. So I understand what teachers are going through.
Wow. And you write about this in your book. And here's a quote I've got highlighted. Making joy happen is a driving force unlike any other I have ever experienced. So when we talk about why teachers stay, this has to be at least one of the big underlying reasons, Alexandra.
They stay for the students. Absolutely. They leave because the adults. It's true. They leave because of administrators. They leave because of district officials. They leave because of parents. Who? You want to talk about parents? That's a whole other show.
So introduce us to the three teachers that you shadowed for a whole school year. And I think you mentioned Penny, who was an 18-year teacher who was making less than $50,000 as a sixth grade math teacher.
Yes, she was a math teacher in the South. I followed Miguel, a Western special ed teacher who was fighting to save both his school and the special ed program that his school board was trying to destroy. And Rebecca, an East Coast elementary school teacher. Now, Rebecca, she hadn't had a date in 5 years because her work was all consuming. And her boyfriend had even broken up with her because he said she was spending so much time at home working on teaching rather than paying attention to him. So I followed her the year she tried to get back into the dating pool to see if she could teach and have a work-life balance at the same time.
Yeah, and she couldn't.
I'm not going to spoil it for anyone. but it's a story that we follow, and you know, the ups and the downs and the maybes.
And I got it. You start the book with the start of a new school year, and I got that feeling of the anxiety, but the excitement of the start of a new school year. And as you detail, it's not just the students that feel that way, it's the teachers as well. They get excited for this school year, and then you go through the school year in your book month by month, and it's just, it sounds like such a challenge to just get back to that making joy that is such a cause or reason for teachers to do what they do.
You know what one of the hardest months of the year is? Right now, March. Some teachers call it Death March because it's like this long slog with no break or holidays.
Yeah, that sounds about right. How big of an issue do you see perception versus reality being here? The work of teachers and public opinion or even portrayal in the news media compared to what you saw and what you experienced in your work for this new book?
The public has no idea what teachers really go through. That was the point of the book. I want the public to be aware of educators' unacceptable working conditions. This wouldn't be tolerated in any other job. We dump so much stuff on teachers. But yet I also wanted the public to see the joys that teachers feel and just how much teachers go above and beyond for, they call them their kids. They don't call them their students. All the teachers, I interviewed hundreds of teachers across the country and they all said, my kids. And that's how they really feel.
Alexandra Robbins, our guest. She is the author of the new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. Just this week, the New York Times listed it as one of 19 works of nonfiction to read this spring. And here's another quote from the book that stuck with me that you were speaking about, Alexandra. Teachers are the country's silent, constant superheroes, and that's a big problem. They shouldn't be our superheroes, you write. Why?
Because what has happened is that teachers have become, as I said, the dumping ground. It's like all of society's failures, all of the government's failures rest on teachers' shoulders. And I'll give you a sort of a somber example of that. The only thing that changed between the 2012 Sandy Hook massacre and the 2022 Robb Elementary School massacre was that teachers were trained to hide their students and barricade the door. Nothing else really changed substantively in society. So this is an example of teachers having to bear the weight and responsibility for society's failures. We saw in the pandemic that public schools were having to feed children because the government wasn't taking care of them. Again, we had to go to teachers and school staff to feed food insecure students. It's like everything comes down to teachers and they're not being paid for it.
Going above and beyond on a regular basis. So you also talk about, and I think this is towards the end of your book, Alexandra, about the catch-22 that the education system itself finds itself in with, you know, a void for teachers, the need for teachers, an education system that would need to change in order to get more teachers. So what comes first? How does the education system change to accommodate a teacher being able to afford to live and do what they love?
Yeah, the job has to change. First, higher pay for teachers. And I don't mean that glibly. Studies actually show that students' math and English scores are significantly higher in districts that have higher base salaries for teachers. We also need more support staff, more counselors, aides, paraeducators, and a full-time nurse in every school. And most of all, we need a job that can actually be managed during teachers' paid contracted hours at school rather than bleed late into the night unpaid.
We're talking with author of 5 best-selling New York Times books, Alexandra Robbins, about her new book, which came out yesterday. It's called The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. It follows 3 teachers throughout the school year, and we want to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest, and what's resonating with you here? What strikes a chord? Whether you are a teacher, a student, a parent, administrator, the custodial staff, it all goes into making it happen every day in the classroom. How are the connections with the teachers and the parents? What do you see from where you sit today about education in America right now? Join us, 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're picking up our talk with the author and reporter Alexandra Robbins. Her new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. And we want to hear what you think about your teachers today, past, present, 1-800-642-1234. And if you're an educator in the classroom, share what you see. 1-800-642-1234. Have you considered looking for another job elsewhere? What is it that keeps you with these kids? You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org, or share your observations on our Facebook Ideas Network Facebook page. And what about the politics of teaching today, Alexandra? Where are the perils in that?
Well, we live in a very strange time. We live in a time where certain politicians are pushing to censor teaching and classroom discussions of race, racism, gender, and LGBTQ issues. They're galvanizing parents by packaging these measures as parents' rights. However, this does not include all parents. Their messages of exclusion and bigotry pander to only a certain small subset of parents. And what this has done in the education landscape is there's been sort of a targeting of teachers who are sort of caught in the middle of the things that they know actually happened in U.S. history, or the things they know they need to teach, or the things that students need to confide in trusted adults like teachers and guidance counselors, and the politicians who are saying, well, no, you can't. And I'll give you examples. A New Hampshire parent group offered a bounty for anyone who caught a teacher talking about racism or sexism in schools, I think $500. A Pennsylvania elected official, a state representative, told right-wing parents to become substitute teachers just so they can spy on other teachers. This is a pretty intense anti-teacher sentiment that not only makes this one of the most difficult times to be a teacher, but also is part of this large national movement attacking public schools.
Yeah, Christina on our Facebook page wrote a challenge they see teachers facing is censorship by the political right. But it's being the way it's we read about it is a parent's bill of rights. Their parents have a set of rights when it comes to their child's education. How do you balance those in the classroom?
Well, you know, I think parents have the right. I'll give you an example. Let's talk about the books. Yeah. Parents have the right to monitor what their own child reads if that's how they want to parent. But they do not have the right to control what all children read. So parents, instead of just saying to their child, you know what, I don't want you to read a book about XYZ, they're saying ban the book entirely, take them out of the library. And worse, now they're talking about pressing charges against school librarians or teachers who have those books in their classrooms and make them accessible to students.
I'm glad you mentioned school librarians, because this is a part of your new book, The Teachers. Alexandra, talking about the role that school librarians play and specialist teachers play as well, and how those often seem to be the first things to be cut when it comes time for budgeting for education.
Librarians are extremely underestimated. Students are actually more likely to graduate, master academic standards, and score higher on tests if their school has a full-time qualified librarian. However, 40% of K-12 schools don't have a full-time librarian, and nearly a third of school districts in our country don't have any librarians at all. We need them. They're central to student success.
Mm. Alexandra Robbins, our guest, the author of the new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. You're welcome to join the conversation. Tell us what you see from where you are today at 1-800-642-1234. And the book details the lives, 1 year in the life of three teachers. And one of those teachers is Miguel, who you mentioned before, a middle school special education teacher. But I also become invested in some of these students that these teachers have in their classroom every way. And one of those that stuck out to me was the relationship Miguel had with Eli in his classroom through the school year. Can you share a little of that with us, Alexandra?
Yeah, Eli had a bad reputation in school. Prior educators have said, well, he comes to school late or he doesn't come at all. And then every year, regularly, he would bolt from the classroom for no reason. And so Miguel started the year saying, he told me, he said, I'm going to treat Eli like the student I want him to be rather than the student that I heard that he was. And he did. He just exuded such a warmth when Eli came to the classroom. When Eli came in, 2 hours late, Miguel wouldn't say anything about being late. He'd say, hey, Eli, I'm so glad you're here. It turned out Eli was homeless. So Eli was dealing with so many more challenges than meets the eye. And Miguel's hard work with him was a really inspiring story to follow.
Yeah, these classrooms don't happen in a vacuum. And you detail this in no uncertain terms in your book, The Teachers, that it's part of the context that are part of the lives of the teachers and the students. But that classroom is so, indelible. I can still remember all the names of my grade school teachers, and they've all become a part of who I am today. So they don't happen in a vacuum. But do we recognize that as the role that these schools play in the lives that these kids have?
People aren't thinking about that. They're not thinking about the teachers. And there are so many teachers who told me they do this. When their kids are at recess, the teachers buy food. And when the kids are at recess, they stuff backpacks of food insecure children with the food so that they know that at least their family will have something to eat. Teachers are doing this, paying out of their own pocket. 94% of teachers pay for their own classroom supplies out of pocket, an average of $500 a year. Penny once spent $2,000 in a year. And part of that is looking out for kids who can't afford things.
Penny is one of the three teachers you detail in your new book, The Teachers: A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. I have to ask you, out of curiosity, after reading the book, did you find the three best teachers in America, or are these just indicative of what you find in any classroom, in any school, everywhere?
Any classroom, any school, anywhere. There are so many teachers I could have followed. I interviewed hundreds. So many would have had great stories. I chose Rebecca, Penny, and Miguel because I knew that readers would both relate to their stories and find them captivating.
Let's go to your questions and comments now at 1-800-642-1234 with our guest, Alexandra Robbins. Camille in New Berlin, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Can you hear me correctly?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Yes, putting more money into the schools. First of all, I was a teacher for over 30 years. I served 5 years on our local school board. If putting more money into the school means that superintendents can create new positions like assistant superintendents, more directors of curriculum, these are two-year contracts. That people earn 2 to 3 times what a teacher does, the average teacher does. And then you can't even get rid of them because if there's budget crunches, because they're on 2-year contracts. So unless we get a grasp on where the money is being spent and put it back into people who directly impact the lives of kids, we're not going to see much of a change.
Camille, thank you for your call and your observation. Alexandra, what do you see there?
Oh, I agree with that 100%. It's called central office bloat. People say, oh, well, we don't have any more money for the schools. Yes, we do. It's just that superintendents and district officials are putting the money into more district official positions, extra chiefs of staff, extra, you know, assistant director of something or other. And Camille's exactly right. And they don't have anything to do with the students. They don't have anything to do directly in schools. And they make 6-figure salaries. It's ridiculous. Yeah, we have the money. It just shouldn't be going to the central office. It should be going to the teachers.
And as you detail in the teachers, it's when Miguel gets an aide in his classroom that seems to turn the entire school year around, even the students.
Yeah, Miguel was getting assaulted in his classroom on a daily basis. He was bitten, he was punched, he was hit. This was the year before I followed him. That happened. And he kept complaining to the district saying, you keep sending me these moderately to severely disabled students, but you're not sending me any assistance. And I can't do this all by myself. And they kept saying, no, you're fine. No, you're fine. Then the district official in charge of assistance came to the school and he showed her the bite marks up and down his arm. And she shrugged and she said, well, that's just part of the job. Well, no, it's not.
Yeah.
It should not be part of the job.
Where else would that be part of the job except for maybe
exactly.
Mixed martial arts? I don't know outside of that, but there's no biting in mixed martial arts.
I hope not.
So one of the things you challenge in your book, Alexandra, is teacher burnout. And you provide a bigger perspective and say in some context, teacher burnout's a myth. Explain that.
Teacher burnout is a myth because, okay, so the phrase teacher burnout is a way of talking about exhaustion from overwork. It's misleading because experts say that the burnout for teachers is caused by inadequate workplace support and resources, high stakes testing, stuff like that. But instead of fixing these issues like any normal workplace would do, districts often say, well, the teacher should just do a better job of, and I'm air quoting here, self-care, as if it's on them to relieve the stress caused by a job that's impossible to do. So I say teacher burnout is a myth. The feelings that teachers have are extremely valid and they're going through this. However, it's not their fault. Instead of saying things like, oh, well, teachers have the highest burnout levels, we should be saying, no, school systems are the employers' worst at providing employees with necessary supports and resources.
Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for your new book.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Alexandra Robbins, author of 5 New York Times best-selling books and a Goodreads nonfiction book of the year. I talked with her earlier this year about her new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession. Coming up Monday on Central Time, Rob Ferret returns to talk with State Senator LaTanya Johnson about what building a budget looks like from inside the powerful Joint Finance Committee and what those decisions can mean for her hometown of Milwaukee. Plus, former Senator Russ Feingold joins Rob to discuss ethics in our judicial branch of government, from the lower court judges to the Supreme Court justices, and how they weigh on our scales of our system of justice.